Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. The University of North Carolina has a long-standing, well-earned reputation for being one of the best and most affordable public systems of higher education in the country. In recent years, however, as appropriations from the state legislature have declined, there has been a growing pressure on the system and state leaders to adhere to the state constitution's guarantee that higher education remain as free as practicable. David Rice of the nonprofit advocacy group Higher Education Works is an expert who knows a lot about university funding and a host of other higher education challenges. Recently, David joined me in studio for a special extended interview in which we discussed some of the good and bad news related to college affordability, state funding levels, and changes in leadership for the UNC system. Well, David Rice, welcome to News and Views. Thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here, Rob.
You're with Higher Education Works. This may not be an organization that a lot of North Carolinians are familiar with. Talk to us about what is Higher Education Works? Why does it exist? What does it do?
Well, Higher Education Works is an organization, a nonprofit that works to build support for our public universities and community colleges in North Carolina. We have 800,000 alumni of the UNC system and even more of the community college system. If you want to put this in supply and demand terms, demand for higher education is not shrinking in North Carolina. We're now the ninth largest state in the country with 10 million people. The Georgetown Center on Education and Workforce projects that by 2020, just 2 years from now, 67% of the jobs in North Carolina will require some form of education beyond high school. Right now, we are at 47% who have attained an associate's, bachelor's, or high-quality credential in North Carolina. So, as we said, demand for higher ed is not shrinking.
Glad you're doing that work. And of course, in North Carolina, we have this historic commitment to funding higher education that distinguishes us from a lot of other states. It's always been more affordable to go to the UNC system. Talk to us a little bit about the history of that.
Sure. We are largely unique. I grew up in Virginia. You don't see newspapers in Virginia with editorials talking about a mandate for low tuition. And most people don't walk around thinking about state constitutions, but North Carolina's constitution since 1868 has included a provision that requires the benefits of higher education to be provided to the people of the state for as far as practicable, which is a difficult word, right, free of expense. So there are only two other states that have provisions like that in their constitutions. One is Arizona, the other is Wyoming. Wyoming, interestingly, consistently ranks among the top five in the country for funding per student from the state. So that's an example of a Republican state, a very Republican state, that supports higher education. North Carolina, we have to acknowledge, there's a difference in scale. Wyoming's, quote, system amounts to one campus with 13,000 students. We have 17 campuses with 230,000 students. But the tradition here has been low tuition and low student debt.
That's obviously contributed to our growth and has helped distinguish North Carolina, probably lifted above a lot of its neighbors that didn't have that, attracting good jobs, building our economy. The last decade, though, there's been some challenges, some real challenges to that. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities put out a report recently called Unkept Promises: State Cuts to Higher Education Threaten Access and Equity. It showed that North Carolina is far from the worst. Some states have had drops in spending that are much larger, but the report still shows that it's down since the start of the Great Recession, about 18.6% in North Carolina. And our spending, when you adjust for inflation as to what we're spending on individual students, is down well over $2,000 per student. That's not a very promising development at a time when we need to really be redoubling our commitment.
Well, you're right to point out that it is a nationwide phenomenon. States have pulled back on support for higher education at precisely the time we need more people with degrees. In North Carolina, the pre-recession level of funding per student from the state was about $12,000, and now it is less than $10,000 per student. So there has been a pullback in state support due in part to the decline in revenues during the recession. But parallel with that, we have seen institutions across the board, both public and private, raise tuition. So there's definitely a shift in the burden for higher education from the public to the individual student and their family. North Carolina traditionally has been well below the national average in student debt, but we see now that we're very rapidly approaching that national average in debt.
And obviously that has a much bigger negative impact on families of modest income, on typically on families of color, folks who are just trying to sort of break into the higher education world, maybe for the first time in their family. And these cuts really are a disincentive for that to occur.
And there are economic ripple effects. It affects whether a graduate can buy a car or a house or start a family. So there has been a diminishing view of higher education as a public good. As tuition has risen, more and more people view it as a private benefit. But there is all sorts of documentation of how education correlates with higher incomes, of course, with better health, with better civic participation. And there is a benefit to the entire community.
There are some out there in the public debate these days who take a different point of view. Some folks, perhaps on the ideological right, who say that too many people are going to universities and they sort of demean the whole idea of liberal arts education, that that's not a value anymore, that we need to just be training workers. And I wonder if you have a take on that as to whether that's something to be taken seriously.
Well, I would again cite the Georgetown Center projections that 67% of our jobs in North Carolina by 2020 will require some form of education beyond high school. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean a four-year degree. And as far as the liberal arts, I guess I would point to Steve Jobs, his commencement address at Stanford, where he talked about how certain characters on Apple keyboards would not exist today if he hadn't taken a calligraphy class at Stanford.
That's fascinating. Well, I mean, obviously, at a certain point, the ability to read and write and communicate, all those things that are polished even if you're not training in a particular science major or training for a particular avocation after you graduate, just those basic skills of surviving in modern society are critically important. And clearly, employers want people who can communicate and who can be active citizens.
There is considerable overlap between the arts and the sciences. When Georgia Tech is looking at their applicant pool, they are looking at a sea of 800 SAT math scores. What they use to differentiate is proficiency in a musical instrument because of the correlations between music and scales are math.
One bright spot, or promising spot at least, in this whole problem of rising cost of tuition and declining commitment to higher education is the North Carolina Promise program that's been developed in recent years here in North Carolina, which allows for lower tuition at three of our state universities. Talk to us about that.
We viewed that as a strong step and a bold effort to try to fulfill that constitutional mandate for low tuition. NC Promise provides for $500 a semester tuition for in-state students, $2,500 a semester for out-of-state students at Elizabeth City State, UNC Pembroke, and Western Carolina University. And all of those schools this year, with the implementation of North Carolina Promise, have seen an increase in applications and enrollment.
That's a very hopeful sign. Let's hope that it's a model for some future further investment.
The legislature committed $51 million, which is, that's a chunk of change.
Let's turn now to the issue of the Board of Governors and just the leadership of the university system here in North Carolina. This has obviously been an issue of great political interest and controversy in some instances. Margaret Spellings was ultimately selected to be the president of the UNC system a few years back, and at the time it was controversial in many circles, but she came to lead the system in a way that found support from both folks across the political spectrum and seemed to be very committed, obviously, to the university system, but is now leaving the university system. She's calling it quits, and Bill Roper is taking over. Bill comes to us from as a veteran of the North Carolina university system as well, and our healthcare system. What do you think? What's going on?
That's several questions.
Yeah, I know.
Let's start with President Spellings. She gets it as far as higher education and the importance of access and affordability. You know, she came here from Texas, was not initially familiar with our university system, but she really began to understand and grasp the uniqueness of each campus. And she also developed a strategic plan that the Board of Governors adopted that talked about building more on-ramps to higher education. And again, that might be via a community college, or it might be by re-enrolling a student who has spent a couple years at college and left. They call those partway home students, and there are a lot of them. UNC Charlotte, in particular, with their 49er Finish program, has really demonstrated skill at reeling those students back in and helping them finish. They have a 92% graduation rate in that program, and it helps the community, as we've discussed, but it also helps that individual, because one of the worst things that can happen is to finish a couple of years of college and have 2 years of student debt, but no degree to help you pay it off. As far as Dr. Roper, he is a known quantity. He will be a calming presence. He has overseen the considerable growth of UNC Healthcare, and he has extensive experience in administering large agencies, including Medicare, Medicaid, and the Centers for Disease Control. I was doing some research about his background when he was named, and I came across a 1990 Washington Post story when he was named the director of the Centers for Disease Control, and it quoted one of his colleagues at the University of Michigan saying that if Bill is an ideologue, he's an ideologue about public health and not politics. And that, I think, he has demonstrated consistently.
He's the interim, right? He's been selected as the interim president of the system, but interims have been known to stick around for a while. You think there's any chance that might actually occur?
That's possible. The chair of the Board of Governors, Harry Smith, has indicated that they're in no rush to rush through a selection process. So it's possible we'll see Dr. Roper in that position for a while.
Now, of course, higher education in North Carolina, you've alluded to the fact it's not just the UNC system, it's also our community college system. We have a new president there as well, Peter Hans, and the community college system is obviously even more massive than the university system. I mean, here in Wake County, it serves, I think, about 1 in 10 people in North Carolina is attending Wake Tech. Talk to us about some of the developments there.
It's big. It's 58 community colleges. 95% of North Carolinians live within 30 miles of a community college. So it is extensive, and as tuition has risen at four-year institutions, community colleges are increasingly seen as a way to get started. Well, I want to point to one program, a pilot program at Johnston Community College that is aimed at aspiring teachers, and the idea is that these young people will spend their first 2 years at Johnston Community College, get an associate degree, and then finish their teaching degree at NC State University, all with an eye toward holding down debt for someone who is going to be in a modestly paying profession.
And that's going to be the case in North Carolina for a while, that teachers will not be super high paid. That's a very encouraging development. There's some similar developments. You've got some stories about some good things going on in our HBCUs, too, our historically black colleges and universities. That's a strong tradition here in North Carolina that with the HBCUs, and there's some still doing amazing work in a lot of different campuses.
Yes, we did an interview a few weeks ago with an interim associate provost at Winston-Salem State University, and she spoke about how she grew up in Weeksville, North Carolina, which is a subset of Elizabeth City, went to Elizabeth City State, and encountered such a nurturing environment there that her professors gave her what she described as the audacity to think I could become a professor. She went on and got a PhD at the Wake Forest School of Medicine and is now an administrator at Winston-Salem State, and she finds a very similar environment there. Winston-Salem State prides itself on social mobility. They don't participate in the U.S. News and World Report rankings. The one that matters to them is that they've ranked in the top 20, and I think this year it was number 9, in the social mobility index that rates colleges according to how much they elevate a student's social status. Another example, and this goes back to the community colleges, Deborah Saunders White, the late former chancellor at North Carolina Central, when Central raised admission standards several years ago, they saw a decline in enrollment, and she had dorm rooms to fill. So Durham Tech is a mile down the road. So she started housing Durham Tech students in North Carolina Central dorms, which served to pay the bills, but also to ease, it served to ease the transition for those students into a four-year university setting. So it was a win-win.
Another interesting development that you all reported on recently at Higher Ed Works is something called the Moss Street Partnership, which is an example of one of these lab schools. This is at UNC Greensboro. Talk to us a little bit about that story.
It's very encouraging. In 2016, the General Assembly required 8 and later 9 UNC system colleges of education to to set up lab or laboratory schools in low-performing schools in their vicinity. UNC Greensboro chose to set up, to partner with Moss Street Elementary School, and they refer to it not as lab school, but they call it the Moss Street Partnership School. And they are experimenting with some of the methods there, and we spoke with an administrator from the School of Education at UNCG who talked about how we don't teach first graders, we don't teach third graders, we don't teach kindergartners, we teach kids. And they like to say they meet students where they are. This year, for instance, they have multi-age homerooms where first and second graders are grouped together because a child that's born August 30th doesn't necessarily know a whole lot less than a child born September 1st. So they're trying to break down some of those arbitrary barriers, yes. Yeah.
That's very encouraging. I mean, one of the criticisms, of course, that's been leveled at a lot of the, we've had this whole development with charter schools in the public school system, and the criticism sometimes leveled at them is that they're supposed to be laboratories of innovation, and often it's just that they're focused on just their particular school, and it hasn't spread throughout the system, the innovations. And so the notion that this is happening at UNCG would obviously bode well, not just for this particular partnership, but for the broader community of the teachers who come out of UNCG.
And the benefits flow both ways, as you say. It certainly benefits the elementary students, but we hope that it also benefits the future educators who are learning how to teach at a high-demand school. And we're going to see at least 8 or 9 of these, maybe more later.
So one last question, and we're getting to the end of our time. The General Assembly, we've got a new General Assembly that's been elected. 2019 looms in the headlights. Any thoughts about what we might see? Will there be any, with a more balanced General Assembly, is there any likelihood that perhaps support for higher education could fare a little better in the 2019 General Assembly?
Well, we'd like to see that. They'll be taking their oath of office in about 2 months and swearing to uphold the state constitution, and that Article 9, Section 9 says as free as practicable. So we'd like to see better support. This is old data, I have to admit, but the last time that the UNC system surveyed salaries of faculty, and this is fall 2014 data that was assembled in 2015, and they simply haven't updated it yet, but they found that 11 of the 16 UNC system campuses had faculty salaries that were below the 50th percentile or the median compared to their peer institutions. And that doesn't bode well for keeping the people who can teach our children.
We'll definitely be watching that carefully and rooting them on. Folks want to learn more about Higher Education Works and read your stuff and get emails from y'all in their inbox. How would they do that?
HigherEducationWorks, all one word, .org, O-R-G.
Check it out, folks. David Rice, thank you so much for all you do for this important cause and for our state, and we'll do this again sometime soon, I hope.
Great. Glad to do it.
Well, that's it for this edition of News and Views. Be sure to check us out online and subscribe to our free newsletters at ncpolicywatch.com. For producer Clayton Henkel, this is Rob Schofield. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to News and Views. A weekly look at state and policy issues is a production of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com.